house, this committee must also be taken seriously. I just want to make that point, Chair. So this bill will be introduced by the team that sits over there. Any political questions we can't ask them because the minister, the deputy minister, is not here.
Yes.
We can't ask.
Different systems, and also we create a new system. So we can say it's too confusing for any parole board to handle. So we want
rather we back to the provision sorry, in the Act itself in Section 73. Section 73, which we will come to, sets out the framework for parole. And we said, let's rather look at this, clean this up without creating a third parole system. The other reason, if we can continue the slide, was that the questions raised as to the legal standing of the proposed incarceration framework. And finally, it was realized that no version of the incarceration framework could actually achieve what Parliament set out to do in 2008, which was not Parliament's doing, which was on the recommendations of the Department at the time. The Department said, if we adopt the incarceration framework, we will create consistency, there will be no illegitimate expectations by inmates, but those are not things that you can create, you can solve by the incarceration framework. You actually solve it by really training the parole board members and having a clear manual. So for those reasons, this book proposes repealing the provision that would have established the incarceration framework and rather strengthening the parole system itself. Then the other major, if we can move to the next slide, the other area that I will speak to very briefly, this is just the background, we will go clause by clause into much more detail, but the new medical parole system. Firstly, where does it come from? Well, Section 79 of the Act currently limits the granting of medical parole to sentenced offenders who are in the final phase of a terminal illness. Now, maybe as a bit of background, the previous provision under the 1959 Act was Section 69, and that provision was much wider than the current Section 79. But then the department found abuse of the system because it created a lot more leniency for granting medical parole with no safeguards built into the system as to the risk of reoffending, for instance. Then came the Section 79 of the current Act, which then, for the department to address the overly broad provisions in Section 69 that went again too far in a sense to only limit it to the final phase of a terminal illness. And in practice, we found that medical practitioners are reluctant to recommend placement on medical parole within this limited definition. And this reluctance can also be attributed to media and societal pressures associated with such recommendations, especially where our own audit of September last year showed that 60% of inmates placed on medical parole do not necessarily pass away. So that's coming to the terminology final phase. As a result, many seriously ill or similarly incapacitated inmates currently do not qualify for medical parole. The department also reports a very high number of natural deaths each year, which shows that something's wrong in how we apply the medical parole provision. This scenario puts serious pressure on already limited financial resources, and therefore, the bill introduces now a new medical parole system, which aims to create this balance. As I said, in the 59 Act went the route of a very broad medical parole system with no checks and balances. Then came the 79, Section 79 under the current Act, which was again too narrow. Now we're trying to create a balance. How are we looking at this balance? Well, we're trying to mitigate the medical condition of the inmate against the risk posed to society. In other words, in brief, what I'm saying is not only your medical condition will in future allow you to be placed on medical parole, you will also, since we're opening the gates in a sense for more medical conditions to qualify, we're also putting in a safeguard by saying, but now we must also weigh what risks will you pose to society. Therefore, there will be three factors to take into account in this new scheme. The first one is whether the inmate should suffer from a terminal illness. See, we don't use the phrase final phase, it's just a terminal illness, or be rendered physically incapacitated as a result of injury, disease, or illness, so as to severely limit daily activity or inmate self-care. What we're talking about here are your stroke victims, which are really comatose, but they don't fall under the definition of a terminal illness, for instance, at current. The second factor would then be the risk of reoffending must be low. And finally, there must be appropriate arrangements for inmate supervision, care, and treatment upon release. So it's a balance of these three factors which must all be present. And then a medical parole is not to be cancelled simply because of a change in an offender's medical condition, but the usual provisions for the cancellation of parole are equally applicable here, such as the violation of conditions for community correction. That is the end of my overview. I now hand over to Benito to take us through the remand detainees and the white paper which informs you.
Thanks.
I will only speak to the side chart, and I hope the members will be able to read what is there. Essentially, we arrived at this consequence of the are then happening like that, it became necessary to the policy framework that governs the management of what we call awaiting salaries and pensions. At the outset, one should say that the existing policy framework governing the management of awaiting salaries became broadly established. Examples in this regard include the rationale and legislative procedures governing awaiting child detention, its partners with a mandate for a month detention, code of conduct and evidence procedure, measures for security, oversight mechanisms, and systems for accountability. Notwithstanding the validity as outlined above, it is also a fact that the existing policy framework has material gaps and misalignment. The presentation, therefore, in the form of that pie chart, we tend to focus on the proposals that are in the bill that are intended to solve the gaps and the misalignment. At the center of that pie chart, we've got remand detention, Criminal Procedure Act, and the Extradition Act. In the first instance, the proposals that the concepts are waiting trial detainees, pre-trial detainees, and unsentenced detainees are on the surface. Misleading since the law, particularly the Extradition Act, does not exclusively provide for detention with a view to the holding and conclusion of the trial. Extradition hearings are only inquiries into whether or not the party in question is eligible for surrender to the effective date. Such hearings do not go into the merits and demerits of the alleged crime. Therefore, it is proposed that the proper definition of this function must be remand detention, and the people managed therein are remand detainees. I will go on a clockwise manner in dealing with the pie chart, starting with the slides on mandate for remand detainees. That one. We'll start there and go clockwise. The responsibility for remand detention is shared principally by four departments: the Department of Correctional Services, the South African Police Service, the Department of Social Development and Respect for Children and Child Labor Law, and the Department of Health and Respect for Remand Detainees with health challenges. The policy framework, therefore, seeks to improve the management of remand detainees across the various departments, and in this regard, it puts due emphasis on the imperative for integration. The next part deals with admission. The first area needing improvement is the admission processes, where we need a list on the number of people to be processed for admission as a remand detainee. This is important for logistical reasons. How many beds should be available, how much food has to be prepared, how many medical officers should be engaged in order to properly examine all the persons who are injured. Yet on the other hand, the alert should provide for the department the people who are that are due to be admitted, the better to prepare for the best mechanisms for managing high-risk remand. In this regard, one may just see the fact that a facility such as the Joburg prison, the part of it that deals with the remand, on an average day, they admit and release 450 to 500 people on a daily basis. There currently is no mechanism that alerts the officials in those facilities about the precise number of people that they are going to be admitting, or even the profiling of such people. So you have no idea how many of these high-risk remand detainees are coming into the facility. So what we're saying here is that we need to know what the number is and what is the risk profile. The risk profile will come from the investigation officer, and the numbers will come from the court and the interproposal that the department must have every officer stationed in the court, so that we just know how much food we should prepare, how many beds we have planned as a police, just in order. So that's the first part. The next part is, flowing from the above are the proposals that an appropriate risk management system is required that will be underpinned by classification of certain types so that they should automatically attract a particular high risk classification. The classification
Chair, as is just reading, we don't have that thing that's really checked. This one?
Yes, it's the slide presentation. I'm just talking to, I think it's on page
ask questions. I Clause 8. No.
Page 10.
Oh, no. That's the amendment.
That's what the policy of it.
Yes, the policy. It's not inside the office.
Page.
No, it's not page 10. It's not copied.
Sorry, has been a different copy on the printer.
Well, it didn't come out.
The thing is, I would like to make notes and ask questions and certain issues. By listening to you, I won't remember all the things that you just said. Thank you.
You know, I'm lucky I can't read, that's why I'm keeping quiet. So, what we're proposing to say is that there needs to be a risk management system, classification of certain crimes that would enable us to classify emancipation and the imperative to accommodate and manage high-risk emancipation, but in the designated high-risk emancipation partners. The next proposal is in respect to a proposal that against the security, but on the other hand, for the security of the management of the facility and for the security of the mandate, and provide them with the security of the mandate and the mandate. We are proposing that the mandate should be provided with clothing that is distinct from that which is provided to those who are serving custodial penalties. So the clothing must be distinct from that which is provided to those who are serving custodial penalties. The proposal is intended to bolster security on the one hand and provide decent and human clothing for self-defense and managing. That's the other proposal that's on that. In this respect, what would happen is that when lawyers or the managing goes to court, he would be provided at the expense of the state Indian clothing so that he does not appear in court wearing that distinct and that would be provided to the managing. The next proposal is to do with improving the surrender of the mandate to the police for further investigation. In this respect, we propose that the surrender of the mandate to the police for further investigation needs to include a role for the prosecutors and the court that would have ordered the money extension in the first place. Further, the surrender should be for a limited period of 7 days, subject to certain conditions. The next proposal has to do with the services that should be provided for mandatees who are within the primary scope, the mandatees with disabilities, the mandatees who are aged above the age of 65 and women. The policy framework proposes a special dispensation for mandatees with disabilities and those who are aged. In other words, where possible, separate accommodation, additional visits for family, additional examinations by a medical practitioner. This is intended to eliminate and minimize any abuse that other inmates can visit upon remanding with vulnerabilities on account of such vulnerabilities are sent to the court. Chair and members of the committee, we would be aware, I'm sure, that it often happens that remanding is due to our identity for whatever convenience. And is done either under duress or by automatic remanding. What we're proposing is that identity swap, whatever is okay, should be criminalized. And this should be added to other infractions that are so categorized in the municipal head. The next proposal is to do with putting a limit to the time that a person can spend in remand detention. We've had situations where some remand detainees spend up to 7 years in remand detention, and quite a large number of other remand detainees spend 24 months and above in remand detention. The extremes in this regard considerably negate the notion that remand detention should not be punitive. and that it should be fair and reasonable. Consequent to it, we are proposing that 2 years be the maximum period that a person can be in the detention. The proposal provides for an extension of this period and other conditions that should affect any release once the prescribed period elapses. We are further proposing a framework for managing information on remand detention and remand payment. Service providers to remand detention, the means and methods employed to guarantee security. There's a proposal that is not captured in this amendment, which will have to be processed by the Department of Justice and Social Development. And that has to do with providing uniform redress for all children in remand detention. Section 28, subsection 2 of the Child Justice Act provides measures for redress for children in detention in all areas. What we propose is that such measures should be easily available to all children in detention, including those detained in the mass detention facility and those detained in the child and youth care center. Chair, the next point is to do with providing a framework that is enabled for the release of the mass detention or the mass detention on account of an asset health condition. A framework is proposed that should enable the release of the mind on account of health conditions. Such release, as proposed, will be attended by several conditions and safeguards. It is better to ensure that the interest of the administration of justice is understood and compromised. Currently, no legislative framework exists that permits for the requirement of the existing system only attempts in the Section 39 of the We're also proposing that there be some awareness programs, probably on a voluntary basis, and the crime awareness program on a voluntary basis that should be available to some of the emergencies, particularly considering the period that we're proposing that they can engulf in the emergency for 2 years. There's another proposal, and that is to do with the fact that the Principal Act identifies infractions and crimes that the remand can commit and the penalties attendant thereto. But in respect to my infraction, what we're proposing is that the penalties attendant thereto and the investigation should prescribe once remand detention for the person in question elapses or comes to an end. There's another area, important area, attending remand detention, and that is the overlap it has with certain considerations of national security. For instance, Section 9 of the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act correctly enables the department to monitor communications by and with people in correctional facilities, including remand detention facilities. It is therefore important that the relationship between remand detention and setting a roadway as national security be underpinned by the construction so that national security considerations do not overwhelm the interest of the administration of justice, which is the core business of remand detention. From an operational point of view, it is quite evident that significant investments will be required to enhance all-round capacity in remand detention, particularly in respect to ongoing training and development of officials on the one hand, and in respect to justice infrastructure. In respect to the imperative for integration that one spoke to, it's quite clear that there is a need for protocols to be entered into by the remand detention facility or management with other stakeholders within government and outside of government, targeting outside of government, particularly those stakeholders that provide services to remind students. The last proposal has to do with the imperative to have an easy mechanism for closure of files or remand detainees. Those are the proposals that are in the policy framework. Now, I may have to say that in respect to those proposals that require the legislative plan, what we have done is we have provided we have translated those into some of the clauses that are in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We also have a second presentation, but I do not know if you've written out questions to dealt with it at a high level, but the second presentation is clause by clause, and we'll go into detail on each of the aspects, but if members have questions.
Can you continue to do that?
four factors as well as the bowl. So they will go four factors in the bowl together with the one that takes the Okay, one is the definition called chairperson, and here we introduce new definitions and we amend one existing definition. Firstly, if members look on page 2 of the bill, we're amending the definition of inmate to make provision for reference to remand detention facility as within this definition of inmate. So in future, wherever somebody reads the term inmate within the bill, it will include both remand detainees as well as sentence offenders. And we will have in future a branch that deals specifically with the issues of remand detainees, which has been established in the department. And the minister will, as you will see if we come to further causes, be designating certain facilities as correctional facilities where we keep sentence offenders, while other facilities are remand detention facilities. Some facilities will be exclusively remand detention facilities, and some facilities will be the current position where you have both at one center, but the one section will no longer just be called medium A, it will be designated as a remand detention facility, just to clarify. So the definition of inmate is merely amended by the inclusion of a reference to remand detention facility. Then we come to the inclusion of new definition. Here we now include the definition for a remand detainee, and it will read as follows in future. It means a person detained in a remand detention facility awaiting the finalization of his or her trial, whether by acquittal or sentence, if such person has not commenced serving a sentence or is not already serving a prior sentence, and includes the person contemplated in Section 9 of the Extradition Act, the same for the purposes of extradition. So basically, it just clarifies the definition of what a remand detainee is. Then remand detention facility, the definition here is exactly the same as the definition for correctional center in the Act. It's just now we will make that distinction in practice when minister declares certain facilities for remand detainees and certain for correctional centers. So the definition for remand detention facility reads word for word the same as the current definition for a correctional center. Then a remand detention official is the equivalent of a correctional official. We will make a distinction and there will be separate training for officials working within these facilities. Then in the process of processing this bill through the National Assembly, it became apparent that we also need a definition for other body within the Act. There are some places where we refer throughout the Act, in about 10 places, where we refer to the role played by either, in terms of the Act, there's three role players who work with parole. It's either the National Commissioner who can place somebody on parole if it's for offense less than 24 months, or it's the parole board for offenses more than 24 months but less than life, and then minister is the person responsible for placing lifers on parole. Those three role players are really the three in the bill, in the Act throughout that deals with parole. Then in some places, when the Act was introduced in 2004, there was inclusion of a reference to other bodies, but there was never a definition, but everybody understood it to mean these two which we're defining here. But just for clarity purposes, that is clear that nobody else would now include this definition for other bodies. So other body here only appears about 10 places in the Act if you do a find and search on the existing Act. And when we refer to other body, it means either the National Director of Public Prosecutions or his or her delegate acting in terms of Section 41 or 53(3) of the Child Justice Act. What this means, and I'm sorry, I didn't provide you with this provision of the Child Justice Act, but this is the diversion provision in the Child Justice Act. So wherever somebody's diverted, then we're referring to it here, as well as the Correctional Supervision of Parole Review Board acting under Section 77(1) of the Act. They can also make decisions as to placement on parole. These are the only other two bodies that we refer to in the Act. And then we insert a new definition for specialist medical practitioner. This definition will be clarified once we come to the scheme of the medical parole in Section 79. But a specialist medical practitioner means a person registered in respect of any profession under the Health Professions Act to whom the definition speciality applies under that Act. This is, when we come to the scheme of the new medical parole system, there's a provision there that makes, if it's a specialist condition, you can get an opinion from a specialist. It's not just your general GP, and then there's this definition that tells you who this person is. So this is what we've done in Clause 1 on definition, Chairperson. I don't know if we should go clause by clause with questions or clarity, or should we go through the whole bill? name clause 2 chairperson, amend section 3(2) of the Act. Section 3 of the existing Act deals with the establishment, functions, and control of the department. Subsection 2 is amended here to make provision for the management of remand detainees. This would be the provision in the existing Act that's kind of like your policy statement of what does this Act intend, and we've now included the reference here of management of remand detainees to make it clear that our focus at the department is no longer just on sentenced offenders, but clearly also on remand detainees. So it's basically a policy statement. That's all we're including here. Then if we move on to Clause 3. Clause 3, Chairperson, amend Sections 5(1) and 5(2) of the Act. Now, Section 5 of the Act currently deals with the establishment of correctional centers. This is what I referred to just when I was talking about the definition clause. This is where Minister will be now establishing remand. It's in terms of a government gazette that will come out and say, these centers from now on will be remand detention facilities. Therefore, if we look on page 3 at clause 3, which amends section 5, it's merely an insertion of reference to remand detention facilities. So that's all we're doing here. We're giving her the power to establish, already she has the power to establish correctional centers, now it's also remand detention facilities. The only thing the committee should also note particularly, because we will, it's a theme throughout the bold scheme, is in sub B, where we're amending the period. Currently in practice, we do not have, we have 239 correctional centers across the country. So clearly, not every small town, not every area has a correctional center, especially in vast areas like the Northern Cape, for instance. So what we do currently is people will be detained if the crime was committed in a small little town, but they have to appear in court far away, they would be detained, and there's no police cell, there's no correctional facility in the area, we would detain people in the police cell awaiting trial. Previously, somebody could have been detained for a month, unless longer period is authorized by the National Commissioner. This has now been amended to a period of no longer than 7 days. In consultation with the South African Police Service, they said, really, even with long distance that they drive, they can manage 7 days. They can manage to get summoned to the court and back with these long distances. 7 days is appropriate period of time. This will link into a further provision that we will come to later in the Act, where we release people on a daily basis into the hands of the South African Police Service for further investigation, for identity parades, whatever. Previously, there was no regulation of that process. We're also now going to regulate it in terms of a 7-day period. So this is just the first provision where we're now saying you will no longer stay in theft for a period, this long period. It will be a period of 7 days. And theft will have to coordinate their own procedures around it. Then, Chairperson, Clause 4 and 5. Clause 4 amends Section 10 of the existing Act by merely repealing it. This was the provision that dealt with clothing and bedding provision for, but we're taking it out here because we're inserting a whole new provision on clothing under the new chapter for remand detainees. So all we're doing here is we're repealing it from this section of the Act because we're incorporating it under Chapter 5, which you will see in a few pages. Then Clause 5, I mean Section 17. Section 17 currently deals with access to legal advice. All we do here is we include reference now to remand detainees. Well, we include reference to the new definition. So previously it read persons awaiting trial or sentence. We're deleting that because we now have a term throughout the bill which is remand detainees. So it's merely a terminology in that provision. Then Clause 6, Chairperson, amends Section 38 of the Act. Section 38 of the current Act deals with the assessment of sentenced offenders upon admission. Now, it is supposed to add in here two new categories on which they must be assessed once they've been admitted to our centers. The first being restorative justice requirements. This is important, Chairperson, that it must be assessed as to what kind of program should go into their sentence plan. So this assessment will inform what will go into the sentence plan. If upon assessment that shows that you should undergo anger management programs or you should see a psychologist, this will now upfront be identified. It's done in practice, but we want it in the Act so that it's clear that everybody must throughout implement it. Then second provision is upon admission, there should now also be an assessment of the vulnerability of such an inmate to sexual violence and exploitation. So it's putting in two new grounds upon which inmates must be assessed. That's what's happening in Clause 6. Then Clause 7, Chairperson. Clause 7 amends Section 39 of the Act. Section 39 deals with the commencement, computation, and termination of sentences. Now, we're amending here subsection 2, paragraph A, by seeking to regulate the serving of any further sentence imposed on a habitual criminal in order to give effect to the month's judgment. I've given the committee copies of the month's judgment, basically what they said in the month's judgment. If I can explain, a person is declared as a habitual criminal by the court if you've habitually committed similar kinds of offenses. This is usually financial offenses. And then the term that you would serve is 15 years, and you can qualify for parole after 7 years. Now the court has found instances in practice, like Mr. Munn, for instance, in the Munn judgment, where he declared a habitual criminal. While he starts serving this, which means 15 years, they find out, no, he's also actually guilty of much more serious offenses for which he should be, the court sentences him then to, for instance, life or 20 years. Now, what happened in practice was there was a confusion as to, can you not only serve the 15 years? What about this extra sentence which came out while you... So all we're doing here is we're clarifying that you serve the 15 and the extra sentence runs afterwards. So even where the parole kicks in, you won't qualify for parole at 7, you would qualify for parole in terms of the longer sentence. So that's what we're doing. If you look on page 4 and you look at clause 7, we're deleting references to habitual criminal in Roman I and Roman 2 because we're inserting a whole new Roman 4 here. And all Roman 4 does is spells out the month's judgment position, which says any determinate sentence of incarceration to be served by any person runs concurrently with the sentence of imprisonment to be served by such person in consequence of a person being declared an habitual criminal. That was the current provision. Now we add in, provided that where the determinate sentence is longer than 15 years, or where such sentence is imposed after a person is declared a habitual criminal, the balance of such determinate sentence must be served after the term of 15 years has been completed. So we give effect to the court judgment. And then if you look at subsection 3, what we're doing in subsection 3, we amend it here by inclusion to the reference to absconding. What this subsection does, subsection 3 regulates the position if somebody disappears from our system. How should that person's sentence start running again once we found the person? So we previously had in here, if somebody was extradited and they returned to the country, or if somebody unlawfully escaped from custody, but we've never made provision for absconding itself, spelling it out. There was omission on our side, so we're correcting the omission. All it says is that if you abscond and we find you, then the postponed then your sentence starts running again from that period. So we're just making provision for that. Then chairperson clause 8. Clause 8 amends section 42 of the Act. Section 42 of the Act is important to our parole system, that is the scheme of our parole system. It deals with the powers, duties, and functioning of the case management committee. Now, the case management committee is your first committee that compiles all information on an offender before it's handed over to the parole board for consideration. Now, in doing this, the case management committee, in terms, is supposed to compile a report with all important information. In Section 42 of the Act lists everything that must be in this report. It's from your previous conviction to the programs that you've completed, all of that. Now we're proposing deleting subparagraph Roman 5, since there's no difference in the way in which habitual criminals and other offenders are being assessed or considered in practice for placement on parole. In all cases, the factors for consideration are rehabilitation and risk, and therefore this provision is no longer used. That is what we're doing on page 5 of the bold chairperson, the bold section there in Roman 5. We're removing the special consideration we had there for habitual criminals. Since in practice there's really no difference, we consider them under the same provision. But so we're inserting a new Roman 5 where we're now including the assessment results and the progress with regard to the correctional sentence plan contemplated in Section 38. That's the provision we dealt with previously. This has never been in here, and it should form part of any offender's profile if he appears before parole board. How have you, which programs have you done in terms of your sentence plan? So there should be an assessment on the sentence plan. So we include this in the documents that CMC must compile. And then if you look at Roman 6, all we're doing there is we're removing the reference to Section 286B, 4B, Roman 2. But if you see in Roman 9 below, We've just gone and spelled it out. We've previously just listed the reference there. We've decided in practice there's some confusion with parole board. It's better for us to spell it out, what we do with dangerous criminals. Again, what is a dangerous criminal? It's a term that the court sentenced someone to in order to protect society. If somebody has committed a specific really violent offenses over a long period, and what it means in practice for an offender is you get either allocated a long period of sentence by the court, and then you have to go back to the court 7 days before that period expires. The court will consider whether you're now ready to be released, or 25 years, whichever is the shorter of the two. But so here we're just spelling out that the possible placement under correctional supervision or release of an offender who has been declared a dangerous criminal in terms of section 286B must be spelled out in the report. Then another important aspect of the amendment here is, if we go to the next slide, is we're now also requiring each sentenced offender to obtain an identity document or foreign national to be recorded as such for security reasons. Persons without identity documents need to be identified in order to be brought to the attention of Home Affairs to determine whether their presence in the Republic is desirable or not, in order to take decisions regarding, amongst others, deportation of such inmates upon expiry of sentence. It's not only for deportation, we also have a lot of elderly inmates, for instance, Chair. And if that person's date for placement of parole comes up, he will not be able to, for instance, find a job because of his age. We would want the department to assist people like that to at least 6 months before they will be placed on parole, apply for social grants, for instance. And if the person doesn't have an identity document, then we've really failed that person. So we've been in negotiations now with the Department of Home Affairs that they will come in and we will set up a protocol process to get this regulated. That's what we're doing on Clause 8. Then Clause 9, Chairperson. Clause 9 is really inserting a whole new chapter. This is now where the UNISO has set out the policy background as to what we want to do with remand detainees. There's always been a Chapter 5 in the Act, but it only had three small provisions for remand detainees. Since the focus of the department was never on remand detainees and such, you can remember maybe in the chapter there's always been this fight, who should look after remand detainees. Cabinet has now settled that fight, it said it's correctional services, and that's why a specific branch must be established, there must be a white paper, and there must be a specific chapter in the Act that gives due attention there too. Now the first new sections are actually a retaining of the existing position. Section 46 is exactly the same wording as the current Section 46 in the Act, which spells out the principles of the regime applicable to remand detainees. So this Section 46, which you can see at the bottom of page 5, is a word-for-word copying of what's in the existing Act. It's just the broad policy process. Then the same with Section 47, which deals with the provision of food and drink. That was also one of the three existing provisions in the Act, which we repeat here, and it's the same wording by large. And then we come to Section 48, which has been in the Act, but not in this current format. Section 48 is now the new provision on clothing. It's on the top of page 6 of the bill. And here it would read, every remand detainee must wear a pre-striped uniform, which distinguishes him or her from a sentenced offender for the maintenance of security and good order in the remand detention facility. Chairperson of this committee can maybe remember last year when 41 remand detainees escaped from Harry Smith. They literally could just disappear into the small town if they were wearing civilian clothing. If somebody was wearing the uniform and there were 46 people running into town, it would have made the situation different. Subsection 2, no remand detainee is to appear in any court proceedings dressed in a prescribed uniform, referred to in subsection 1. Now, when remand, this is the current position. When a remand detainee comes in, you keep your clothes. We will lock your clothes in a closet. This is what we will do in the future. We will give you a uniform. But some remand detainees, the clothing in which they were caught is really not appropriate to appear in court with. And secondly, the police might take it from you for forensic purposes. There might be blood drops on it, whatever. Now we're giving you a uniform, but we're saying when you go to court, that's what subsection 3 does. If a remand detainee does not have adequate or proper clothing to appear in court, he or she must be provided at state expense with appropriate clothing to enable him or her to appear in court. Again, this shouldn't have a big influence on our current practice because we currently do provide remand detainees with clothing where it's necessary. I just wanted to go into detail of that provision. Then Section 49 really provides for safekeeping of information and records. If, again, we still spoke to that provision, it was found in practice that there's really no, the institutional memory on remand detainees is not as in such as much detail as on our sentenced offender. So we want to start keeping more, ensure that we keep records properly. Then sections 49A, 49B, 49C, and 49D. These deal with our vulnerable groups amongst Remand detainees. Here we first have pregnant women, where we say, these are provisions that we stipulate here in addition to, remember, wherever we have the term inmate in the Act, a Remand detainee will be covered. So, for instance, there are provisions that deal with women who may keep children up until the age of 2 years old. There are provisions dealing with health provisions. Well, there's provision dealing with access to health care for all inmates. But what we're doing here is we're going above and beyond in certain instances. So I'm just going to read these provisions. I must say these provisions are mostly coached as it is with all socioeconomic rights in the Constitution to say within available resources, because we can obviously not roll this out one time across the whole country. But for pregnant women, we say every remand detainee who on admission plans to be pregnant must immediately be referred to a registered medical practitioner for a full medical examination in order to confirm such pregnancy. The National Commissioner must, within the Department's available resources, ensure that a unit is available for the accommodation of pregnant remand detainees. And then thirdly, every remand detainee, every pregnant remand detainee must be provided with an adequate diet to promote good health as prescribed by regulation. On disabled remand detainees, section 49B, if the National Commissioner considers it necessary, having regard to remand detainees' disability, the National Commissioner may detain disabled remand detainees separately in single or communal cells, depending on the availability of accommodation specifically designed for persons with disabilities. The department must provide, within its available resources, additional health care services based on the principles of primary health care in order to allow the remand detainees to lead a healthy life. Here the research of Melissa, for instance, has shown that it might be one thing to provide somebody with particular equipment to assist in their disability, but the department must also go further and provide the physiotherapy or whatever in order to use whatever assistance mechanism is provided. The department must provide within its available resources additional psychological services if recommended by a medical practitioner. Then on the age for remand detainees, now the definition of age in terms of the department is in line with government, it's anybody of 65 years in age and above. The National Commissioner may detain remand detainees over the age of 65 in single or communal cells, depending on availability of accommodation. A registered medical practitioner may order a variation in the prescribed diet for an aged remand detainee and the intervals at which food is to be served, when such a variation is required for medical reasons and is within the available resources of the department. Then for mentally ill remand detainees, here I must just explain what we mean with mentally ill remand detainees. The Mental Health Care Act does not apply to remand detainees. So I know a lot of the time members would say to us, but why inmates with mental health care problems should not be in your centers. We agree with that, but that's under the sentenced population. We can unfortunately, the Mental Health Care Act doesn't apply to remand detainees. Similar, that's why we define a mentally ill remand detainee here in reference to the National Commissioner may detain a person suspected to be mentally ill in terms of Section 77(1) of the Criminal Procedure Act, as provided members with a copy. 77(1) is if you appear in court and it might seem that you do not have the capacity to understand what you've done due to a mental illness, you will be sent to Best Copy or to one of the centers for mental observation. Unfortunately, we have such limited bed space that a lot of these inmates await bed space in our facility. So this provision is firstly directed at those remand detainees who are waiting bed space for observation, and secondly, or a person showing signs of mental health care problems. Now, this might seem very wide, but if you walk into a center, and this committee will also receive a briefing from the ministerial staff that the minister appointed last year, February, to go to all, they traveled the whole country last year, went to all 239 correctional centers to look at specific categories of inmates and specific sentences in relation to overcrowding and vulnerability. Now that report, once it's gone through Cabinet, which should be within the next month, will come to Parliament and a briefing to both the NA committee as well as yourself will be out. But what they found is, when they walk into a cell, they also say, how can they identify somebody with a mental illness? But in every cell almost in the country, in every center almost in the country where you walk in, there will be a cell where people have been isolated by our correctional services staff due to mental health problems, where they do not qualify under the Mental Health Care Act to be placed up. They do not qualify under Section 77 to be sent for observation. The court has already said you can stand trial, you have the capacity, but they have severe mental problems. It's, for instance, in Baltimore, people with severe withdrawal symptoms from TIC. So what do we do with that population? We have to cater for them within our centers, and this provision is trying to do that, to say that they can be kept in a single cell or a correctional health facility for purposes of observation by a medical practitioner, and the department must provide within its available resources adequate health care services for the prescribed care and treatment of the mentally ill or remand detainee. And finally, the department must, within its available resources, provide social and psychological services in order to support mentally ill remand detainees and promote their mental health. Now, Chairperson, coming to Section 49E. Section 49E is again where Louisa refers to, we're putting in place a new medical parole system, but what do we do with inmates who are severely ill? Usually in practice what would happen is the inmate would be brought before court and the judge would say what should happen to the inmate. But, well, that is the ideal in practice. In practice, however, what happens is we call the court and say, this remand detainee is too ill to appear, so postpone. So he never appears before a court so that an intervention can be made as to these conditions. So we have remand detainees who are passing away in our centers where they could have been placed over elsewhere, but could they not brought before a judge to make such a decision, we're stuck in the situation. So this provision is basically, it uses the same terminology for medically ill as we're using in the new definition for a medical parole. But the scheme of the provision is based on Section 63A of the Criminal Procedure Act, which I've also provided members with copies. Section 63A is the provision of the bail protocol. It's got a scheme of how you bring somebody before a court if he's not due for appearance in court. And what this involves is providing a role for the head of the correctional center to work together with the National Prosecuting Authority. And we're not saying this person will be released into society. We just want role players to take notice, the court to say, either he must now be placed in a court where previously I said he shouldn't get bail, he's now so severely ill, he can get bail, but under these conditions. So all this provision does is it brings the really ill remand detainee to the attention of a court to make decisions as to what should happen further. So I'm not going to read through the scheme, but the scheme is set out on page 7 as to how it works in practice, the head of the correctional center who alerts the courts of the process. Then section 49F deals with release under supervision of the South African Police Service. Again, this is something that occurs daily in South Africa at the moment. They do it under what is called the SAP 127 form, yes. Temporary transfer of detainee. This used to be regulated by Section 73(1) of the 1959 Act, but a similar provision was never retained in the new 2004 Act, in the 1998 Act, which came into operation in 2004. So we're basically addressing oversight here by writing it specifically in here and regulating the process so that it's also trying to protect us in a situation where currently the police can come to our center, take somebody, and we do not have a paper trail as to where the person has been taken for further investigation. There could be corruption on both sides, so this creates such a paper trail. But it limits it to a period not exceeding 7 days that somebody can be placed into the custody of SAP. And this would be to take somebody to the scene of the crime to point out where the crime occurred or identification parade, etc. So that's what Section 49F does. And then the last provision under this chapter dealing with remand detainees, Chairperson, is Section 49G. Again, that's where Louisa referred to. This is the provision where we're limiting the period that a remand detainee can stay in our facilities to 2 years. And this means they won't be released upon reaching the 2 years, but again, it's a process of bringing it to the attention of all role players. Currently, you are aware as a committee that there's people awaiting trial for periods longer than 2 years, up to 5 years, sometimes 7 years. And this is a process where we're trying to curtail what's happening in practice so that all role players know after 2 years, this person will be brought before a court for the court to apply its mind whether there's a need to further the statement, first of all, whether SAF and the NBA is ready to proceed with the case, wherever the holdup might be. But so that's section 49G. Then, chairperson, you can move on to clause 10. Clause 10 is just a minor amendment. It amends section 54 of the Act, which deals with day parole. It's the insertion of a reference to ministers. Ministers included here, since it was an omission not to have done so in amending the Act in 2008, by determining that it's the minister who decides on the placement on parole of lifers. So basically what section 54 does is regulate placement on day parole, and it was an oversight in the past not to include a reference to the minister. Then clause 11 amends section 70 of the Act, which deals with non-compliance with conditions set for community correction. Here the amendment is proposed to cater for cases where offenders relocate after being placed in the system of community correction in order to avoid unnecessary delays and costs. So it's a practical arrangement, chairperson, that just says that you can go to your nearest parole board instead of us transporting you to wherever you were originally placed outside a particular parole board. So it's a practical cost-saving amendment. Then clause 12. Clause 12 is now where, in the beginning where I spoke about the policy and why we no longer have an incarceration framework. If we had an incarceration framework, then we would have deleted section 73. But section 73 we're now retaining for the reasons I've spoken to earlier. This is the provision that sets out all it regulates granting of parole in South Africa. So everything that deals with parole is in section 73. But in retaining section 73, there's a lot of terminology that you can see we're amending, because it was proposed to have been deleted originally, so a lot of amendments here is terminology. But before I talk through the specific amendments, I just wanted Carl to just take the committee broadly through the kind of, then we can explain in the next slide, Nomelo. That's the current, here I'm just trying to show whatever we're doing in section 73, this is the overview of the types of parole you can get in South Africa. If your sentence is less than 24 months, more than 24 months, which Carl will talk to just now. What I've attempted to do here is summarize remember we've already got these two parole conditions, systems. So it's the system under the 1959 Act, system under the 1998 Act, and then what we're proposing today. So what I'm trying to do here is to show that really we're not amending anything in such a way as to create a third parole system. Wherever we're making amendments is to people sentenced to a very short period, less than 24 months for instance, who by the time the Act kicks in would already have been through the system. So we're not creating a third parole system. That's what we're trying to show you. I just wanted the committee to understand the different types of parole we have and what amendments we are making. So I can hand over to Carl just a second.
Thanks. I refer to Procedure Act, Section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act, basically indicates what type of sentences a court can hand down. And then our Section 73 states how such sentences must be served, so the two goes together. So if you look at 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act, first it can be sentenced to imprisonment, periodical imprisonment, and declared a habitual criminal. It can be committed to another institution, a fine or correctional supervision. If we look at this section 73 that we now amending here, if a person is sentenced to imprisonment, it could be for a definite period, more than 24 months, then the consideration state is at half of the sentence. If it's a definite period of imprisonment, less than 24 months, would be consideration as a quarter of the sentence. If a person is sentenced to life, it's 25 years. If a person is declared a dangerous criminal, the maximum sentence before this person must be referred back to court would be 25 years. Periodical imprisonment would be served over the weekends, and our correctional services regulations, in Regulation 34, deals with that. As was previously said, if you declare a individual criminal, consideration would be after 7 years. And then if you look at the different forms of correctional supervision, so the first part that I explained is consideration for parole. Correctional supervision, where a person could be sentenced directly to correctional supervision by the court itself. And then there are instances where the national commissioner can grant correctional supervision or refer a person back to court. life imprisonment of not more than 5 years. As an alternative to fine, that person can be immediately considered for parole. The reason being that the person was in any event sentenced to fine as an alternative to imprisonment. In other words, if the person was in position to pay the fine, that person would never come to our facility there for consideration immediately on that. In a case where a person is sentenced to a sentence of not exceeding 5 years, the consideration they can be at 1/600 sentence for correctional supervision. Imprisonment of more than 5 years as our attempt to the fine, if they prescribe is not more than 5 years in the future, it's a quarter of the sentence in these particular cases, the person must be referred back to the court of law. In other words, it's not the commissioner that would consider or a parole board that would consider correctional supervision, the person is referred back to the court. Then, there's also another option. The national provision that also refers the person to court of law if there's direct imprisonment and it's not more than 5 years until the expiry of the sentence. In such case, the consideration or the referral back to court would be at 1/4 of the sentence. And then a reconsideration of the sentence in terms of section 276 and 38. In other words, court should be imposed not necessarily for its supervision, but could be imposed in other sentence if the person is referred back to the court in such case. That in short is what we're dealing with in terms of section 73.
Chairperson, if I could explain then further, if members look at this scheme that I've provided them, without going into, looking at the clause itself is a bit confusing and understand what they're amending. That's why I've provided members with this scheme. The only things we're amending is if members look at the third issue, where first from the top, referring to corrective training, and then fourth from the top, referring to prevention of crime. We're deleting these two since they're not being used in practice anymore at all. No court.
Which one again?
It's the third and the fourth from the top. It's corrective training and prevention of crime. We're deleting these since they're not being used in practice anymore. Nobody has been sentenced to corrective training by a court for since 1994. The same with nobody has been sentenced for prevention of crime, which has been a bit absurd in the past. So that's why we're deleting that. Then if members look down from that, three options down, where we're referring to sentence under section 51 or 52 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, this was the minimum sentence provision. If you were sentenced to a minimum sentence, the Act said that you had to serve at least 80% of your sentence. Now there's been a lot of public outcry about this since you're already sentenced to a harsher sentence, so the department decided to scrap this provision. You will now, if you're sentenced to a minimum sentence, serve half of your sentence. Like for other long-term, like we've said here, any other long-term sentence, more than 24 months, you serve at least half of the sentence. So that's the third amendment. And then the last amendment, Chairperson, is second from the bottom. It's where we're saying any sentence has been 65 years or older. The current position has been, if you're a lifer, and that's why this shows it as such, it was only always applicable to lifers, we're opening it up to all offenders. The position in the Act has been, if you're a lifer, and you're sentenced, if you're sentenced to life, and you're aged 65 years and above, and you've already served 15 years of that life sentence, then you could qualify for consideration of parole. It doesn't say you immediately get parole, but you qualify for consideration. Now we're also saying, say for instance you're somebody who's not a lifer, but you're sentenced to 50 years. The court just said 50 years. You would have only have qualified after 25. Now we're saying if you're 65 years and above and you're sentenced to a very long period of a sentence, you can now also qualify. So it's just opening it up to that small group of the age. And I think our statistics have shown us that there's really only around 300 people that this provision would apply to in any case in practice, but it's a humanitarian consideration for the age. And in any case, it doesn't qualify a person for parole, it's just for consideration of parole. So, Chairperson, if you look then at what we're doing on page 6, on page 8 and 9, is on page 8, 73.1, we're only amending terminology. 73.2, we're only amending terminology. In 73.3, this is another provision which is amended. Previously, it used to read that upon sentence expiring, in other words, not parole, This is not a medical parole case. Your sentence expires next week. We used to have a provision where if the medical practitioner said it was in the interest of your health or to protect the community against whatever disease you have, you could be detained longer for such purposes as the medical practitioner decided. This was felt by a lot of commentators to be very unfair, since this person has really finished serving his sentence. But as we know, South Africa, we do have health legislation that says if you have a communicable disease, for instance, drug-resistant TB, there are certain legislative provisions that will kick in as to where you should be held, whether you should be allowed to mingle with the community, etc. So rather, we're rewriting this provision that we say, if we're aware of somebody that's so ill, we alert the health authorities. That's what we're no longer going to detain you, but we're alerting the health authorities, and they must then either detain you in isolation if it's a communicable disease of that nature in terms of their legislation, or they must make bed space available for you in a hospital in order so that you can be removed from our center to a public hospital. So that's what we're doing in subsection 3. Subsection 4 is really terminology. Subsection 5 is terminology. And then from subsection 6 until page 10, the end of subsection 7, are the amendments I've just spoken to, the four amendments that we've made here. So I will not go into them again, but it's from subsection 6 and 7 have been amended to provide for the four amendments that we've shown in the scheme of the parole system. So 73 really sets out how we deal with parole system in our in South Africa. Then clause 13, chairperson, which is on page 10. Here we're amending section 75 of the Act. Section 75 of the existing Act deals with the powers, functions, and duties of the parole board. A further function of the parole board is added that it can decide on medical parole. This was an omission, so you will see, for instance, on the bottom of page 10. We just added in reference to medical parole throughout, since this was an oversight in the past. Further, it clarifies the position that a decision of the parole board is suspended pending a review of the decision by the parole review board. This is on, so we've only dealt with terminology on page 11 up until subsection 8. Subsection 8, here we're inserting a new section where we're saying, well, somebody, what happens in practice now is, for instance, in the Carmichael case, which was in the news recently, we became aware that the victim was never involved in the parole hearing, which is a major oversight. So we've recommended from the minister's side under our powers in terms of the Act that this decision must be sent to the parole review board. But in the meantime, that inmate has been given a date of a particular date to be placed on parole. What happens now? Whilst the case has gone to the review board, in practice, we do not release the inmate. But we're writing it into the Act now to make it clear that that is how it works. So if your case is sent to a review board, you have to wait until the outcome of the review. So for instance, we will be held liable if that person reoffends while he's on parole and the case was actually under review at the present moment. Then two other provisions which the committee should take note of is on page 11, it's new subsections 9 and 10. We're here basically saying subsection 9 that the minister can only cancel correctional supervision, day parole or parole, if it's an instance where she has placed somebody on correctional supervision, parole, or day parole. So it will only be life. It is the current practice, but we are again filling it out. So the minister can't cancel somebody else's medical parole, for instance. She doesn't have the power. She only has powers over people that she placed on parole, which would be life first only. Then we're also inserting a time deadline here that we say all matters referred to the review board must be finalized within 4 months. This is just a practical arrangement to get matters dealt with much more quickly in practice. Then, chairperson, really, the last provision that's of big impact, the others are very small and we will run through them quickly, is the scheme of the new medical parole system. I've dealt with the policy, but I'd now like to talk the committee through the individual sections of this. Firstly, subsection 1, the three role players that can place somebody on medical parole is the National Commissioner, if it's an offender with a sentence of less than 24 months. It's the parole board if it's an offender with a sentence longer than 24 months but less than life. And it's the minister if it's a lifer who has a medical condition. So those are the three role players. There's always been the three role players in the current scheme as well. But now then we stipulate what conditions can the consideration be given. And this is where we're now having this balancing act all three factors must be present. Such offender is suffering from a terminal disease or condition, or such offender is rendered physically incapacitated as a result of injury, disease, or illness, so as to severely limit daily activity or inmate self-care. Now, members may ask, what conditions are we talking about here? This will be spelled out in the regulations. We will come to the regulations at the end. The regulations in this instance will come back to Parliament. This committee will also get a chance to look at the regulations on medical parole. As part of the regulations will be a scheme which we're currently developing together with our doctors in our centers and know which conditions we're talking about, together with doctors from SAMA, South African Medical Association. They say to us end of March, which is next week, they will be ready with their first draft on these conditions which will go into. So there will be a table of specific conditions, which are the conditions that we're faced with currently in our centers. So this will provide guidance to medical professionals in terms of what we're talking about in A. Then B, so not only must you have a medical condition, secondly, the risk of reoffending must be low. And thirdly, there are appropriate arrangements for the inmate's supervision, care, and treatment within the community to which the inmate is to be released. Apparently, this is also a condition that we do attach, because you cannot place somebody out if there's no space in a hospice, for instance, or if the family lives very far away. We have to arrange with the clinic in the area that the clinic physically goes to the house to give assistance. So it's that factor. But currently, we do make these arrangements in practice, because we kind of just release somebody in this condition without making sure that there is proper care for the person upon release. Then subsection 2, an application for medical parole shall be lodged in the prescribed manner by, here I can just say currently, if only the medical practitioner who can initiate the medical parole application. Now we're opening it up. That's why in this as I go along, we'll see where we open up the golden safeguards, but we're opening it up. We're saying it's a medical practitioner who can initiate application, as well as a sentenced offender or a person acting on his or her behalf, so a family member, a lawyer, whoever, can initiate a medical parole application. Now, in order to balance this, we're saying in subsection B, an application lodged by a sentenced offender or a person acting on behalf on his or her behalf, in accordance with that previous paragraph, shall not be considered by any of those role players if such application is not supported by a written medical report recommending placement on medical parole. So we're saying you can't just have an application and waste all the role players' time. It must be backed up by a medical report. And this medical report, again, in the regulations, which we will base on the Scotland UK example, they've got a pro forma form that will be in the regulations where you will fill in the medical condition, you will motivate why you think it falls within the scheme of the Act. So that will be the written medical report. It will be guided by what we put into the regulations, which is working well in other countries. Then Part C says this written medical report must include, amongst others, which will be spelled under regulations, the provision of a complete medical diagnosis and prognosis of the terminal illness or physical incapacity from which the sentenced offender suffers, a statement by the medical practitioner indicating whether the offender is so physically incapacitated as to limit daily activity or inmate self-care, and reasons as to why the placement of medical parole should be considered. So that's just giving a scheme as to what this written medical report will look like. Now, subsection 3 is one of the important oversight mechanisms that's built into this scheme, since we're throwing it open to a wide range of medical conditions and a wide range of role players. The minister will appoint a medical advisory board for the country. How this will operate in practice is there will be representatives across the country. So nobody will be traveling from Gauteng for a case in the Western Cape, but we will appoint people across the country who will sit on a medical advisory board. So you will have this written medical report on which you initiate the medical parole application. This will then be sent to the medical advisory board, which are independent. So this medical report could be by your own. As an inmate, you could have your personal doctor and he motivates you to be released. So what checks or balance do we have? We're sending it to an independent medical advisory board, which will then either support or shoot down this medical parole application based on medical grounds. And then subsection B, as I said, when we dealt with definitions, here we can also, we're creating the opportunity, if we do not have medical expertise on this board, you can send it to a medical specialist. Because obviously we cannot appoint people across the country with all possible expertise. So it leaves it open to be sent to a specialist. That's all that subsection B does. Then subsection 4, the placement of a sentence of tenure or medical parole must take place in accordance with the provisions of chapter 6 and in subject 2. These provisions in subsection in chapter 6 are the provisions of community correction that you can be placed, well, the conditions on which you can be placed. So it's just repeating a reference there too, and it's repeating the fact that the informed consent must be given by the offender to allow access for all role players to his medical, to his personal private medical report. Then subsection B of 4 says an offender placed on medical parole may be requested to undergo a psychological medical examination. Why did we include this provision here? If you're released today on medical parole and you can, you're bedridden, we will place conditions that will not require you to undergo further programs or to find work or anything because you're bedridden. You might now recover once you're outside of the conditions of the prison. But since we've taken into account, which we will come to in subsection 5, the risk that you pose to society, you will not be reincarcerated unless you violate your parole conditions. Because we've already, in placing you on medical parole, taken into account, do you pose a low risk to the community? But now if you recover, we find it by taking you in from periodical medical examination, we will amend your parole conditions. We will, for instance, say you have to do 16-hour community service. You have to attend further programs. You have to find the work. You have to report to a different, you have to physically, where we now send people to come and check up that you're there and everything, you have to physically come and report to us. So that's why we want periodical medical examination in order to amend your condition in line with your health condition. Then subsection 5, so up until really subsection 4, we're dealing with the medical part of your consideration for placement on medical parole. Now from subsection 5, we're looking at your risk for reoffending. And that's why we're saying here, we're making a determination as contemplated in subsection 1b, which is that the risk of reoffending must be low. The following factors, amongst others, may be considered. Whether at the time of sentencing, the presiding officer was aware of the medical condition for which medical parole is sought in terms of this section. For instance, we have found an inmate in a wheelchair who was a gang leader who was already in that position when he was sentenced, but he's still running gangs from that disabled position in our facility. In order to mitigate against the fact that he can now come and make use of this new medical parole scheme, we will take into account whether, or for instance, we've also had cases where people, minister has gone around to centers and found people in wheelchairs who have amputations, but the amputations came about as a rape for a cash and trump with big shootouts, yeah. And the judge saw the person in that condition, still sentenced the person to life. Then you will not qualify for this. Your condition has been taken into account while sentencing. Any sentencing remarks of the trial judge or magistrate, the type of offense and the length of the sentence outstanding, the previous criminal record of such offender, or any factors listed in section 42D. 42D was referred to as the report of the case management committee, the one we were adding new factors to, as we said earlier. So all the factors in that report of the case management committee, together with these additional factors, will be taken into account in order to determine whether your risk of reoffending is low. Then we're just saying in subsection 6 that, of course, in consideration of this kind of parole, it's no different than other types of parole. The victim has a right to make a presentation. Subsection 7, we're saying position that a decision to cancel medical parole must be dealt with in terms of section 75, 2 and 3. 75, 2 and 3 is your general condition for canceling, which is the general provisions applying to any parolee will be the same in this instance. So, the fact that you've improved in your health condition will not make a difference. Then subsection 8, this is the scheme for the promulgation of regulations, where we state within 6 months after the promulgation of the Act, regulations regarding these procedures must be adopted, but the regulations must be submitted to Parliament for approval at least 1 month prior to promulgation. So it's not just for Parliament to note, it's for approval, so amendments can be made to the regulations. And that's just the scheme of it. Then, Chairperson, that's really the gist of the Act. Just very quickly, Clause 15 amends Section 90, which is just a terminology issue where we're adding in reference to remand detention facilities in the powers of the inspecting judge so that he can also visit those facilities. Clause 16, we're adding in to what Lolito referred to this committee to in his presentation on the new defense that we're creating for falsifying identification, identity swap. And then we're, of course, inserting in Clause 17, which amends Section 134 of the Act. 134 of the Act is where we deal with regulations. Here we're adding in all these new regulations that will flow from all these new provisions on remand detainees. Then Clause 18 is merely an amendment of the scheme of the table of contents. And Clause 19 and 20 I've spoken to in the initial presentation, where we're repealing the provisions referring to the establishment of the incarceration framework, because we've cleared up that system in Section 73, which is taking it to a broad system. And then the last clause is, of course, just the short cycle information. Thank you very much.
Before I'm asking questions, this is the first briefing of us. Will we have time to go on our own to go through this thing and come back again with more detailed information? When today? But it's the first briefing. No, Chair. I think that it will be totally unfair, because there's a lot of things, and I don't think it is realistic, honestly, to go through all these papers and amendments and expect that we must make an input into this. My suggestion is they must give us time, maybe 2 or 3 days, for us to go through this thing and come up. Maybe there's amendments that we. It's for the first time that personally I see this.
The issue really is that this is a Section 75 bill, and we're doing it for concurrent basis. Reading for further information, I think we should allow that, but we propose that I haven't read it, but on listening to it, and I carefully listened. In fact, I was saying to myself, he has a caring state in action term. Basically, what these amendments to me, in my observation, what I've listened, is that they are trying to clarify certain conditions, and they are also giving particular, taking certain responsibilities in relation to how inmates are treated, and the clarifying the status of the reprimand offenders, and so for me, Chair, the detail that I got from the presentation, and of course with the benefit that I haven't read the document myself, but you know, as they were presented, I didn't find anything that would say really to me I need to go back and read and take other time, besides the fact that this is a Section 75 bill. And there are questions, Chair, and questions, for instance, where there's a clause that is giving the minister to designate certain facilities into being reprimand facilities. One would be, we've always had problems with the space, as it were, whether that would, it's just a question of reservations, whether that would be able to be implemented and all that, and here we are, the department says boldly that we will do it. You know, whether they would find the spaces in the situation where they don't have even the spaces currently as we speak, you know, all of those kind of things, Jeff. actually check that they have a whole host of things that are happening in the first time. Thanks.
Would you like to make some input after having gone through the document?
Yes. I want to make some input after I'm being given time.
How long will it take?
A day. I can do it tomorrow. I must get time. But let me ask him. Yeah, it's fine if you consider that.
Yes, I was just thinking you can work through the document if there are any opportunities you would like to meet and submit them to the consultation and forward them to the
structure. Procedurally, we would adopt this bill and it is in the field of goal to help clarifying the policy, but it won't change the amendment as well, so that's actually clear.
Chairperson, I would support the fact that he does the input and submit it, but that doesn't change the fact that we adopt, we note and adopt this in this meeting. As I was listening to, I nearly got bored somehow, and I was very bit drowsy because these are specifics. I mean, as I'm listening, definitely on Bloom, Honorable Bloom, I know prison have been there. So as I was listening to me, I thought that we, not for the fact that we didn't read this, but these documents were in our emails and prison holds. And then even if we didn't have time to read them, there's a lot that is here, contained here, and what is being heard. I did listen and carefully listened and I understood some of the things. You won't follow them by reading these things because these are specific things that relate practical situation that prison. I think Honorable Bloom knows exactly. But obviously, we have to be cautious not to just accept everything, to read them properly. First, I would support the fact that, yes, he can just note and add whatever he wants to and submit it later. Later, which will be tomorrow then. You won't sleep tonight.
He's saying that I won't sleep tonight. Chairperson, let me ask questions. What is the time frame to establish this remand center? What is the time frame for them to establish this remand center? That's the first question. Who is going to provide staff for this remand center? And who is going to train the staff? This issue of uniform for the awaiting trial prisoners. You see, with me, this new terms of detainees and what. You see, there is no remand. You see, that's why crime is so dangerous in this country. We are bringing all these fancy terms and whatever, remand, detainees, and what. If a person has committed a crime, it's a prison. It's a prison. And I will stick to that. That is what I believe in. But I'm asking the question. Why must taxpayers still pay for a different set of clothes, uniform, for this? In the first place, these people are not yet being sentenced. They are awaiting trial. Now, you come in, you get a uniform to wear inside. Chairperson, you see, all these type of things. You see, the Sunday, the Sunday City Press, where there was a lot of corruption reported, SIU. I can tell you that in this whole thing, some of these things will be outsourced as we speak now. And I am just raising this to the thing. The uniform, one. Why must we give awaiting tribes uniform? I have raised my questions. I will do follow up questions in that way.
Mine chairperson will come close to this one of Honorable Blomul, the issue of corruption. That in what I think, because as I'm listening, I understand his question, and then I understand what the department said. Because if those people who are there awaiting trials, they run away, very difficult to just get them in the towns or wherever where they are running, because they look like everyone. But if there's a way of making sure that you are able to identify them, it's possible to get them. But the point is, in the changes that we are doing, what the mechanism that we put in place so that, as Honorable Blum is saying, we ensure that we close the deaths or opportunities for people for issues of corruption. For instance, as he says, these things of outsourcing, opening up tendering for these things. How do we ensure that everything that we do, we close gaps, we close everything that creates a space for any criminal or corrupt activity to take place? In relation to exactly what he's asking, I think for me that is very relevant, because at times people think that we are comfortable when we not saying anything about corrupt activities. And I think it is important that the department, when they come and present us here, at least they must show us their anti-corruption strategies. Thank you.
Chair, you see this argument of escape, prisoners awaiting trials escape, and then they can't find them. Inmates are escaping in this orange uniform, and they can't find them. So there's no argument in saying that these people must now get. Are they also going to give awaiting trials in police stations? The very same thing. Because in the police station, more people escape in the police station than in prison. And in prison, I'm asking, are they also going to give people awaiting trials in police stations? Johannesburg police station, there's a lot of people there. That is my follow-up.
No, just I think that department.
Then the last thing that is maybe on this again. What it means to say they go to courts with inappropriate clothes? What is that? What does that mean? What people are supposed to be wearing in courts? How well do the poor get the suit?
The suit and die.
Thanks. I will respond to some of the questions. The time frame for the establishment of the French effectively reminds the name in correctional facility as we speak. So it's not like this is going to be a new function altogether. The fact is, throughout the country, there are facilities that are accommodating and wherein people are waiting the finalization of their trials or inquiry in terms of their practitioner act and management. There are facilities that are dedicated exclusively for such people. There are facilities that have responsibilities on the one hand that are managing those who are serving custodial penalty, who are referred to as sergeant commanders, and on the other hand that are managing those who are trying to get. So in real terms, it is elevating that function to a different level. The staff already, there are officials in the department who are managing those who we refer to as the man's team now, and those who are managing those who are serving custodial penalties now, and those who are serving offenders. Further to that, there is, I think the minister has already approved, in accordance with the relevant regulation, the structure for the new branch of the man detention. And I suppose that has been consulted with the Department of Public Service and Administration, both at the executive and the administrative level, and also with national treasury. So effectively, there is a process in place that is intended to make sure that happens. I think the rest will add a bit to that. I don't want, I won't be able to raise that now. So the answer to it is, this is an ongoing function which will be elevated to a dedicated branch once the bill has been signed into law by the president, once it has been approved by the CSOP and the National Assembly. Now, the issue of training, that will have to be, I would imagine, the training that takes place already. But in the presentation I made earlier, I indicated that one of the areas that requires sustained attention, if you will, is the issue of training and development. And in the policy framework, the intention most definitely includes raising awareness around corruption, raising awareness around security. I mean, if Luiso was involved in terrorism and our demand staying there, there is an imperative on the part of the department to raise awareness. Or let me talk about something else. One of the things that is absolutely apparent is that on training and development, continually you need to reflect on what does evolution of cell phone technology mean for the management of the business and for the management of the people inside. If I'm a sophisticated IT person and I had a cell phone such as all of us have, such as this notebook, this is almost, if you will, a computer, and I can get into the internet, I can do so much harm using my cell phone from behind the safety of this wall. So from the training and development point of view, you need on an ongoing basis to reflect on those things and say, how do you make sure that you've got effective countermeasure against any wrong that may be committed by a remandee or some person serving a custodial penalty using a cell phone? I'm just making those examples. So this has got to be elevated to a different level. There must be a research and development that underpins it. You have to reflect on the kinds of things. What crimes are likely to happen or are likely to be committed by prisoners, including near time, etc. So issues of training are things that we have to really think about more carefully than across various departments, bringing people from intelligence, bringing people from the procedural authority and the center. So you need to have, if you will, on an annual basis, a calendar of workshops, so that you make sure that your officials are made aware and receive appropriate training on a wide range of things. Once you chair is that, and the proposal that we're working on, the framework of it is that the issue of training is something that's got to be taken very, very seriously. That's why it was on the slide. It's got to have appropriate resources, and it's got to be an ongoing thing. You can't just receive training on recruitment and joining the department. Now, I think I've attempted to answer those first two questions from the board. Then the issue of the uniform. There is a reality in our facility where when we went around the country, I remember we met with a marginal race in Mekata, and he was challenged by a remand detainee. He did not know, he just saw Lois walking into his offices, and the men pulled out a knife and wanted to prostrate for the emergency. But for some people, seeing the thing and then what's happening, and of course the president escaped and ran away. The reality is, the design of some of our facilities is such that it is easier for remand detainees in those situations to sort of attempt even to intimidate a chief magistrate. Yet, the reality is, I am not suggesting that you are going to have police or going to court as well proposing in law in the uniform, but it makes it people that blend with the visitor, and you can't tell who is the visitor and who is the remanded. That's the first problem. So from a security point of view, whatever the anxiety is, the reality is, remand detainees being in their food, in their own food, makes it a slightly difficult to manage them from a different point of view. Further, we have had instances where Mr. Bloom gets admitted and is wearing the very nice attire that he is wearing, and on walking into a cell, he immediately becomes a target, because suddenly somebody else sees his nice clothes that he's wearing, with a Gucci or something of the sort, and they attend. So the security is also for some of them, and we have had many of those instances. Lastly, there are many remandees who are really very, very destitute, or if they are not destitute, as the point was made, I was arrested and my crew have for some evidence, and that those clothes have already taken for forensic evaluation, blood samples, etc., etc. So it leaves many of these people literally very, very in a very, very exposed type of situation. And some of them have had to be provided with different clothing, which would be the orange uniform. So what was with because they would agree to that. So what we're proposing is that the state must provide clothing that is distinct from that which is provided in those of certain custodial finances for the purposes that one has in the state. Now, Chair, I wouldn't be able to explain and commit the department, because this is a law which is not going to be applicable for the next year and the last year. I cannot imagine that I can commit the state in terms of where will the uniforms will be controlled for 15 years. And except for that, this is just the policy. I would imagine that maybe one of my colleagues can give an answer to that. I would imagine perhaps that what we can say is that we need to rethink, the state needs to rethink outsourcing some of those things, and to the extent possible, such clothing must be controlled from within. Now, we are proposing here that the same clothing must be provided to remand detainees. This will principally attend those remand detainees in the custody of the Department of Correctional Services. And the reason for that is we do not want to propose that the same clothing must be provided to those remand detainees who are in police custody. Now,
your arrested person, not necessarily your remanded person. What we're proposing in terms of those who have appeared in court and the court would have given an order that this person must be remanded in custody pending whatever, those people, to the extent that they would be in police custody, they will be there for only 7 days. And the numbers and the conditions there are such that in our view, it is possible for them to remain in the custody of the police. Because it's for specific purposes, it's the surrender of police for further investigation. And where somebody is arrested, is saying there is no remand detention facility, he has to appear in court in another 3 days or so. There's no point in having the person 250 kilometers away and bringing him back. So in that situation, our view is that we can afford to have such people not being provided with the children that we're proposing. Purely because the time is the proposal that this case must appear in court before presiding officers and children closes that it was felt that it would not be appropriate to have such people appearing before presiding officers wearing a uniform or whatever needs. And it's consistent with ongoing practice. In fact, some of the sentenced offenders do appear in court for additional crimes for which they have been charged. And to that extent, because they are already serving custody of penalties, they do not appear in court wearing their orange uniforms because they are already serving sentences. To that extent, they are provided with civilian clothing where they do not have their own religious descent for purposes of appearing in court. So what we're proposing is that the same procedure should attend the appearance before presiding officers by remanded. In other words, they must appear in their own clothes, and where that is not possible, then the state must provide clothing for them. In respect to remanded detainees within the vulnerable group, if it is advised by a medical practitioner that the department within its available resources should alter a diet in respect to, for instance, diabetes or any other condition, if there is that suggestion by a medical practitioner, of course, the department, that's the spirit of what we're proposing, that we should try and attend to the specific needs of the remanded within the vulnerable groups. That would also include additional medical services that would be provided to such a person. I will stop there and allow my colleagues to answer.
Thank you, Chair. If I may, on the cost implications of establishing a remand station as well as the provision of clothing for remand detainees, I will make available the provisions as it was presented to Cabinet in perfect conditional to the committee, like we can make copies for members. But there is a cost, there's been a costing thereof. The clothing specifically, currently how it works, we've got factories across the country, and it's inmates who make these uniforms, and it's from very durable material. In the portfolio committee, we had a similar question, and at that stage, unfortunately, that person was involved at the conference today. The response was given that these uniforms can last up to 7 years. But what will happen is we will make a once off, there's an average roving category of between 45 and 50,000 remand detainees. So they will come in, and they stay for, some persons might stay for 1 day, some persons might stay for the duration of their 2 years in this particular uniform. But when you go to court, you hand it back to us, we wash it, we hand it to somebody else. But even with washing it every 2 to 3 days in the current system, the sentence defender's uniform can last up to 7 years. It's made from very durable material. So that's where the cost implications are one of initially, but it lasts over a number of years. But we can make these numbers available. There are estimates, however, for the establishment of the branch as well as the clothing. Again, on the establishment of the branch, the deadline is around May next year to a full position in the branch itself, May 2012. But I would recommend that this committee, through your chairperson, consider inviting the specialists, since they couldn't be here today. I will relay the message, especially through Mamelo, who is the parliamentary liaison officer, to invite the minister. can provide the committee, but I do not want to talk to the numbers myself because I would not be able to answer the questions on the exact numbers, but I will hand it over to the clerk now. But that is my understanding on the uniform and the impact that will have for the taxpayer. It has been costed, but it will be an initial and then it will be phased out over the years. Then as to the vulnerable groups, currently it's covered in Section 8, whereas in Section 12 of the Act, which deals with nutrition and health care. If, like Louise was said, currently even you're identified as a diabetic, you have a right and you can be sued if we do not provide you with food that falls within your particular dietary needs. So we're already liable for that. As I said, these provisions, for instance, Section 8 says each inmate. Now we've amended the definition of inmate, so inmate includes remand detainees. So all the other provisions of the Act for hygiene, exercise, all of these will be applicable in the existing Act to remand detainees as well. Then, as to the tender question, this really doesn't fall within, again, I would recommend that that would be an issue brought to the attention beforehand of the department when they come and address this committee. But I can briefly maybe just say, in closing the gap, it's been more practical issues than in the Act itself, but it relates to what has been found by the SIU report, which has been in the media again on Sunday. That report was handed to the Minister in 2009 in September. From that report, there are practical recommendations that the Department Minister accepts, so in the National Assembly when answering questions that have been implemented, where, for instance, particular tender procedures were found to be not in alignment with Treasury regulations, etc. Again, I do not feel I have the authority to say which those are, but the CDC, well, the CFO can come and unpack exactly which amendments have been made since 2009 to bring our procedures for procurement in line with recommendations by the SIU.
I move for an adoption.
Chair, I wasn't in the off question.
No, we're talking about the
adoption. I second the adoption.
I'm abstaining. I want to put it on record. Abstaining in
members who have indicated that they want to make my trip.
Thank you, the Jason Kirk and the Democratic Alliance support the bill as adapted by the
National Honorable Deputy and Honorable Bula, I wanted to ask some questions. Maybe before that on section 9G, we are talking about the maximum what informed you to school students is appropriate? Especially maybe to take into consideration the people who have come to the drive.
Whilst I was listening to the bill, I wanted just to hear something from Lois. Am I right, Lois?
Yes.
You were talking about Lois, who is a criminal who saw you in Transgar High. So I was afraid now to say that. I wanted to hear maybe more when you talk, because I'm just thinking now the bill, the branch that we are establishing, the department seeks to establish. I'm interested to know, is what we are doing in line with the job creation that we're talking about? Just fit your politics in this thinking in my mind of job creation. And I do understand what you said about the anti-crime, what? Anti-corruption prevention strategy. I do understand what they're saying then, but we will have to. But I think, I don't know how best can it be done. I think it will be very important when we're developing these deals that somehow we try to find a way. It might not be here, but we also raise somewhere within the department so that our corruption prevention strategies, we try and tighten them up. Because every time we are coming with something new, because this is something new, what you are coming up with, this might be or might be assisting some of the things that are in mind with me, like the issue of job creation. But somehow, obviously, as creative as people are, because they are hungry, and they will come up, even those who had enough before, they will come up with strategies to try and, you know, push us left and right in what we want to do. But if I'm just interested to hear more, I mean, in relation to job creation, is this bill assisting us towards that direction? Because it is in the interest of everybody in South Africa that more jobs must be created for young people and other people to have work. I'll be happy if just you can take me close to that.
Actually, I don't know which questions has been asked, but as I was listening through the presentation, it looks like that the department is going to do things, or inmates, or what you call them, are going to be treated. Has the department ever considered the training of the officials who are working with the inmates? If you look through these things, I'm saying to you now, it's impossible to do this. Well, the system which you are working now throughout this country. The other thing that really, really is for me a big, big, big concern. I don't know, and I heard that this thing has been adopted, all this. Is that the department are spending so much money? This will be billions of rand. I'm telling you now, it's a lot of money. And the question still remains: will our community benefit from this development? As my colleague has just asked a question about creating sustainable jobs. Or will our people again be being demoted? Just okay, we create a job for you, but you must clean the dishes. Someone else will get the money. Those are my biggest concern. And the last thing is, I've heard what the minister said to one of the women's question about the clothing correction and so on. I'm not speaking of things which I didn't know. I was there myself, not as a criminal, as a political prisoner. And I've seen what has happened in prison. And I normally do pay prison visits now that I'm a member of parliament and a member of legislation. And I've seen what is happening. And I've seen with my own eyes how people have been treated inside the prison. That's what I'm saying to you. The system that you are trying to do might sound good. I always put the question, will it benefit the people? Because I've listened to one thing you said, 6 months before the prisoner has been released and all that. I can give you an example of people who are coming out from years out of prison, years ago in prison. They still go back. Because that the training that you people are giving to the inmates, I don't know in other prisons, but it doesn't look like it's assisting to rehabilitate them, to make them fall into the community and so that they can work. But it's been adopted, so what can we say? Thank you, Chair.
The question of training has been responded to, and the question of the cost.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. No, people don't know. I'm used to
be the second this man, people are still hating him up until the chickens were not safe when these are around. Chairperson, let me ask this question. What is going to happen if any awaiting tribe prisoner refuse to wear this uniform? You see, these people are not sentenced. They are still innocent. What is going to happen? That's the first one. You see, they are having rights because they are not, say for instance myself, you are giving them food, the right to have their private food from home. They can bring their own medical practitioner in. That's right. Now, if this is a law, you are going to get a lot of challenges, court challenges. What are you going to do?
Maybe in addition to that, the social insurance, I mean, the feeling of difference from those led by the center in
the
living thing. Maybe there's a question I think there are of what you must do. The government invested in Sikawaka on the facilities that assisted the university to deal speedily with the education. Why would it take such a long time for a person to be demanded for procurement? Because some legal people even say justice delay is justice delay. Why can't it be done?
I just want to add Chairperson to you. Why are we not told here that, exactly as you are saying, what has been done during the World Cup, why it can't be sustained now? I mean, tell us, because you know exactly what are the challenges. What are these challenges? How do you think they can be met in the process so that we can do exactly what we said? The legacy of the World Cup should live with us. Why seemingly now on these issues it seems not to be living with us?
Thanks, Chair. I won't have monopoly over the answer. The 2 years, Chair, is a difficult one. I hope you have an answer question. It was bugging the National Prosecuting Authority, particularly the National Director of Public Prosecution, very, very strongly feels on a year. That the year is about to limit any type of scandal if it stays charges that have been and the money that has been captured. The which was facility. The detectives on the other hand prayed for a more liberal period of time, which was about 3 years, even 3 years. Because the investigation of these people is not like a time to dig up the sermon of a priest, the husband. The particularly clear offenders in the organized crime environment, it takes special skills, and those skills are not readily available, that's right. So what we eventually agreed to was that it is reasonable for a person to be in remand custody for a period not exceeding 2 years. And if the person has to remain in custody after 2 years, then the authorities must persuade the court that this person must remain in custody. So that was the, it's trying to strike a balance, a healthy balance between the views of the prosecutor authority against the views of those who are actually doing the detective work. Now, about 2 weeks ago, the rep will bear me out on this one. We had a discussion in her office, and we were looking at what's happening around the Eastern
in a facility such as East London and in Delta, overcrowding on average over the past 3 years has been standing at about 150 to 170 facilities in particular that is approved to accommodate about 300 plus inmates. In real time, on any given day over the past 3 years, if you have anything between 600 and 750 inmates. Now, the same can be said about East London, except for that the numbers are slightly lower. But there's serious overcrowding there as well. Now, if you took the figures of the remanded inmates, as I've just explained to you members, and you pull data on the functioning of the court, the court there, and the rate was shocked at it, because there are courts there that sit on average 15 minutes a day. That would dispose of about 25 cases in a month, or 15 cases in a month. Now, that tells you where the real problem is. It's a bit of an imperfect thing, what I'm saying, in the sense that the cases that would have been disposed of, you do not know whether they are the cases of the specific people who were in the manifesto. But with those intersections, consider, if you are going to have courts that sit on average, the national average is about 3 hours for a court in South Africa. Now, if you've got, even if you did not have imperfections with investigation capacity, etc., etc., you need to improve the function of the court. You need to improve the numbers of detectives. Currently, the country has got about, I think, 26,000 detectives, 23,000 of whom are active. We've got less than 1,000 crimes in excess. We've got a limited number of forensic science laboratories. I think the bigger ones are in Victoria and Cape Town. We've got, on average, about 2 million cases that are registered with the South African Police Services per annum. It does not mean that the 23,000 detectives are able to investigate and conclude the 2 million cases that they were registered with the police last year. Many of those cases are going to be rolled over into the new year. Yes, about 400,000 of them are going to be run, etc., etc. So the reality is, and we agree with the right, is that the key one of the core functions of the remand detention branch will be to play a very, very active role in the deliberations on the criminal justice system. Because you cannot do the pragmatic thing of saying, we've got 700 inmates in Kingstown, therefore let's move 100 standard offenders from Kingstown and move them to the Free State, the part of the Free State that brought us to Eastern Cape. And therefore you move these 150 from Kingstown to Kingstown, and therefore your statistics are going to reflect acceptable levels of overcrowding in Kingstown. That's just cosmetic. The real function, the real challenge is improve the functioning of the criminal justice system. You need to increase the number of detectives. You need to improve the quality and the training of detectives. Better facilities, forensic science laboratories, etc., etc. That is what we said we need to agree on, and we agree that from then onwards, the two of us are going to jointly attend the meetings from the department. In fact, one of the things we agreed on is that your management at the provincial level also needs to be assessed to the extent that they are dealing with these issues rather than just dealing with the problematic issues of how many people you have, etc. The core challenge is that we have to improve the function of the criminal justice system. And to that extent, the 2 years becomes business. If that system functions much better, then of course you can by all means reduce the maximum period to about a year.
Maybe just add on there before we move on to a new point. Then the FIFA issue, again, I would recommend that this committee considers maybe calling a joint briefing by both SAP Justice and Correctional Services. We're really at the end of the process. We just received people. We couldn't improve the functioning of the system, but I know what they did in Justice, for instance. They cleared up court rolls. Where currently you have to wait to get in, and they cleared up court rolls. So if you deal with a particular number of cases, they did learn very valuable lessons, which has prevented to the cluster. from the CSOC process of working together as a chapter, from those lessons they can come and present to the committee, but it's difficult for us to speak to those on behalf of the other departments, but it's a big difference to focus on X number of cases and you get everybody involved in one instruction than the daily overwhelming 2 million cases being reported yearly, 700,000 go through the MPA process alone in a year, compared to the limited number of cases that we could throw all our resources at during the FIFA. But I know that there's very many.
Thanks, Chair. I will then move on to the issue of the training. I know I've answered it, and I want to repeat what I said. I did say, however, in the original briefing that our view is that considering that remand detainees are going to be there for about 2 years, they need to be exposed to some voluntarily to some underground awareness program. Now, on this one, Chair, if one looks at the profile of an average person who is managed there, it's somebody who, by and large, comes from a socio-economic environment. They fail metrics, and they are not in possession of any skills worth talking about. Now, what in essence is required of the department is that where open society, open state, schools, further education and training, etc., is failed, the Department of Correctional Services must improve and produce somebody with better skills. I don't know if I'm putting this thing across well. Now, there is no way you can do that if you have an average lawyer who himself does not have any skills worth talking about. Again, I say that with very great respect. So, and you therefore need a totally new approach on how you empower, how you use those who themselves need to be empowered to empower those who are in need. It requires a fresh and new approach altogether, and my sense is I don't think we're quite there yet. Bricklayers, welders, and those types of things, yes, you can sustain that, but I'm not sure South Africa today is a place where if you gave Loiso those skills, Loiso is going to make it outside with a guarantee at least that is not going to come back. The issue of job creation is a difficult one in this respect. One does have some views. Most definitely, if you create a new branch, it's going to require new facilities. So the construction of the new facilities, there will be some jobs created. But that I do not know the sustainability of the jobs beyond the completion of the project. Of course, you are going to employ more people, so there will be new jobs. Some jobs will be outsourced, notwithstanding the concerns of Mr. Bloom. So there might very well be some new jobs there. But I'm not sure one needs to put too much emphasis on an entity of the state such as correctional services to create jobs, because then you can make the department to be a bit more creative, and that can be at the cost of the core function. The refusal to wear uniform, I'm not sure on what basis one would sustain that refusal, because the constitution provides for the limitation of rights, and I think the law before this amendment provided that no person in remand detention should be forced to wear a uniform. And there was a proviso. Basically said, no uniform, it allowed for a uniform, but it had to be distinct from that which is provided to those who are serving as the death penalty. And I think international protocol provides the same thing. It should never be a uniform that is similar to that which is provided to those who are serving capital penalty.
So the limitation of Christ, and with the fact that we're proposing the provision of healing from which is distinct from that which was provided to those after the public penalty, I'm not sure. And if we are putting on a legislative that it's justifiable, it's reasonable. I'm giving your ideas.
I just wanted to say, we believe that there is no justifiable limitation. We do not say there will not be challenges by inmates. We would actually welcome the first challenge, but then we can go through the exercise. I'm sure somebody might challenge it, but this process, as you know, Mr. Bloom, all our legislation has to be presented to the National Council of Correctional Services before it can come here, and there are 3 judges there, and this provision was debated there by them, and they all seem to agree that it will pass constitutional muster. That's beyond the point that the State Law Advisors Office is here today as well, and they certified the bill as being constitutional, having weighed the same concerns. So we believe it's a reasonable, justifiable limitation. Somebody who's awaiting trial, especially since we make that distinction as to the uniform, that we're not treating you the same as a sentenced offender. But we do not say that people won't challenge it, but we will welcome the first challenge to them.
Limitation of rights.
Yeah.
So remember, there was a court challenge, and it was successfully win in the High Court. Awaiting trials were not supposed to vote, and they won that case. This one, I can bet you, they are going to win this one. For them not to wear uniform. They are still not sentenced. And if they go to the Constitutional Court or to any High Court, they are going to win this case. I can tell you, I can bet with you. Because there's no obligation for them to wear that uniform.
I thank Honorable Chairperson Troy. Thank Honorable Bloom. Even if you are playing and you forfeit your right, that's one. We should be saying it will be very important to close any loopholes on this. Because I would agree, I know exactly what you are talking about when you're talking about the identification. I know what used to happen. I used to see what happens in these police stations. They get out in front of the police and they leave. Once they're in a police station, it's very, very easy to get out there and walk out, even in prisons, because there are people which are visiting. So you can't distinguish. So I think you need to put more nice ways that explains that in an institution, state institution, people who stay there for that period that they are there, they need to be clearly identified by those who got the responsibility to look after them. I think you need to put it in such a way that Bloom's fears are allayed here, so that even those who might think that they can do this, I think, Honorable Bloom, there are limitations of rights. You can't open up everything, open for some. It's very, very chaotic, that situation. In fact, I'm saying we need to make sure, because I think this needs to happen. I think it needs to happen, it needs to be done. I mean, prisoners can't tell us, even if they are not, they are still alleged. They have not been tried and sentenced. Whilst they are there, it's because there's something. They must prove themselves. If they are innocent, they must stay there. Wait there till their cases are over. And they must be identifiable so that they can be seen. I think, to me, it's very, very important. It's very, very important because, Honorable Bloom, as I'm saying, I know exactly how people leave these prisons. We used to leave prisons in front of prison wardens.
You
as see, politicians.
I have waited for that one. He's still on the run up until today. This one.
I'm here, now that man won't find me.
The security we're talking about, the correction of services does not meet the requirements for the school.
Education. Is it about education?
there should be education. What I know is minister has taken a position that we have to have compulsory education to young people, mainly.
I remember.
No, this thing is wrong there, but it is not practical. Mr. Paxton know what I'm talking about. You find a cell like this, there's 150 people in a cell like this. How will you give education? In all the prisons, it is not that MOU, it's fine. It is on paper, but practically, the chairperson is asking a education facility. That is what he's talking about. It's okay. Go to Portsmouth now. There's that MOU, but practically, you can't do it with this overcrowding. That is that.
Almost possible.
Can I just say that as we will be reconvening with CDCs and other people, they would rather unpack. Because I understand what Honorable Moon is raising, and I know there are some steps that are taken. Rather, a person that is responsible in ensuring comes and unpack what are the suggestions that are coming up, as pertaining to compulsory education to young people.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very intelligent and very eloquent.
Thank you, Chair.
Just on the point of clarity, Chair, it was in general, in fact, that the Honorable Member used to deal with the Honorable Member.
Yes. This one is still on the run. Mr. Paxton. Please take him with you. Please, you are having uniform. Please take him. There's one. The people in Upington are still crying. They are protesting that he's a member of parliament. There was a march last week in Upington. I received a memorandum. Don't ask me. He was problematic, this man. Then Papalelo.
No,
that's why.
He have to bring a uniform.
See, that's why he wants people to wear uniform. Because he's still on the run.
He will have to bring mine here.
No. Get out of parliament.
I'll bring my back here.
Hey, Gunda, you know, I met one guy in Saint Louis there. He said to me he's from Robben Island.
Yeah.
Fine. I said, what was your crime? So he said, no, I used to go to this.